Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and welcoming back for a third appearance in the book club, warm welcome to Dave Wynn. Dave, welcome back.
Hi Eamon, great to see you and thanks very much for having me back once again. Great to be here.
Oh, it's delightful because I can see, we can now see each other on the video. I've got nothing in my background, but in yours, you've got musical instruments and a great poster print of Prog 61's cover, I can see.
Yeah, the Big Man cover, absolutely fantastic. I bought it about a decade ago. I can't remember where. It was a site that did a number of 2000 AD large covers, and I saw it and just had to have it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I'll say to people, remember to vote for your top 10 2000 AD covers for episode 300, which is coming up. Send those to mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. Now, Dave, we have done some Scarlet Traces. We've done some Strontium Dog. Third time, here we go. What is the book you've chosen for your third visit?
I have chosen Judge Dredd's City of the Damned. From Progs 393 to 406, which was over 1984 to 1985, I believe.
Indeed. Written by Wagner and Grant as T.B. Grover. Art, Steve Dillon, Ron Smith, Kim Raymond and Ian Gibson. Letters, Tom Frame. Edited by Steve McManus, of course. Now, I have got in front of me the Titan edition, Titan 24, I think it was. There you are. You've got the same one. This was from 1986 with the Bill Sienkiewicz cover. I should say, like Spaceman of 2000, if you want to read along with us, you'll find City of the Damned in Case Files 8. But as you say, yeah, here we are. We've both got the lovely Titan edition, haven't we?
Yeah, and it's a glorious cover. I think it's one of my favourite covers from the Titan reprints. But this Titan book that I've got actually isn't my original. I did first read City of the Damned in this Titan book way back when I was about 14 or 15 years old. But this one I have here isn't the original copy because I gave my original copy away. We had a visiting family from Scandinavia when I was about 14, and their child was about the same age as me. And although we didn't speak much English, we bonded over comics, over the 2000 AD and Dredd. And he started, while he was there in his visit, he started reading this City of the Damned, the Titan Books version. But by the time he had to go, he'd only gotten halfway through. And I just couldn't let him leave without knowing the end of the story. So I gifted him the book, you know. And I don't know, but I like to think that maybe somewhere in Scandinavia there's like a 50-year-old bloke who became, if not like a Judge Dredd and 2000 AD fan, at least a fan of a comics, maybe kicked off by my gift. Who knows?
If by any chance you're listening, send us an email. Dave would like to know how you got on with City of the Damned.
Yeah, right, he definitely loved it anyway.
So we had Scarlet Traces. We've had Portrait of a Mutant. Tell us why this particular one for the book club.
Well, it's a huge favourite of mine. And I thought for the book club, well, we've done kind of like English literature with, you know, War of the Worlds and Scarlet Traces. We've done in the Portrait of a Mutant one, we covered some very, very serious topics like prejudice and fascism and stuff like that. And this time I thought, well, you know, I'd really want to just do one of 2080's great ripping yarns. There's no real subtext or anything to learn from the story. It's just a lot of fun to read. So I thought, yeah, City of the Damned really fits that bill.
So it's one of the remaining early Dredd epics that we haven't got to yet on the pod. So here we are, we're getting to it. A mid-80s Dredd epic. Let's just do the basic setup of City of the Damned. What's the sort of the setup that takes us off on the adventure?
So it picks up from a previous story, The Judge Child, where the Judge Child himself, Owen Chrysler, was supposed to be some kind of savior for MC1, saving Mega City 1 from a grisly future that the precogs had kind of, you know, projected. And however, Owen Chrysler was dispatched by Dredd in the previous Judge Child story. Yet the future warnings were still coming through from the psychics. So using Proteus, a Justice Department prototype-type kind of time machine, Dredd and Anderson are flung by the Justice Department 13 years into the future. And just to have a look at what's going on in Mega City One, and they arrive and find that the place is in a state of corruption and decay, and there's all kind of like monstrous denizens munching on citizens and doing all sorts of them. And Dredd and Anson basically set out across the city to just figure out what's going on. Yeah.
So, marvelous stuff. Wagner and Grant, at the peak of their powers, setting up this wonderful idea of sending Anderson and Dredd and Anderson into the future to find out what actually is the disaster that was foretold for Mega City One. It's pretty grim when they get there. There's not, things are bad in the future.
Yeah, yeah. The decay is very, very beautifully depicted. The decay and everything's crumbling. The walls are falling apart. The citizens are eating mold from the walls. That's all we've got left to eat. It is a very unpleasant future Mega City One, isn't it?
And not only, as you said, we've got weird looking monsters in Mega City One munching on the citizens. The other thing, the other sort of creatures that are munching on the citizens, of course, are the judges of the future.
The Hell Street Blues, yeah. Brilliant. And they actually use a couple of the characters from the TV series Hell Street Blues, don't they?
Yeah.
Hang on.
Belka's one of them, I know.
Let me just quickly flip to the pages. I'm sure I spotted one, and I was like, oh, the plainclothes cop was one of them. Belka. That was Belka, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or Renko. Renko was the blonde-haired guy who was like the uniformed officer, wasn't he?
Right.
Yeah. So the 2000 AD as ever gets the kind of cultural references in there.
So there's these weird sort of vampire judges of the future, the Hell Street Blues. As you say, they're obviously taking a pop cultural reference from Hell Street Blues. You get a great cover with that from Ron Smith. Even future Hershey has been affected, although she doesn't turn into a sort of demonic Buffy the Vampire type vampire. She still looks like Hershey, doesn't she?
Yeah, and she's a very seductive Hershey. I was drawn by Kim Raymond, if I remember correctly.
It is, yes.
Yeah, which I always thought was great. I really loved it, you know, as an impressionable teenager. Yeah, and in fact, I actually like Kim Raymond's art, but I guess we'll talk about that a bit more later. So,
well, before we turn to the art then, let's just say about John and Alan writing this, because I think we all know that it was originally intended to be a much longer epic and to run half a year or so. And it ends up being curtailed. And I'm guessing you've probably heard the same as me, that John and Alan just got a little bit fed up with it and didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of see why, can't you? Because it's a series of kind of like vignettes. You've got the Hell Street Blues, then you've got the dinosaur things, then you've got Dredd crawling through the fire. It's like, how many things can you throw at them, and how many kind of like ideas can you come up with to keep it fresh over a long extended period of time? I personally think that they actually made the right decision to make it a kind of short epic, a short, snappy epic, which never really overstays its welcome and ends and the final scenes in the city of the ruined Mega City One with the Dredd versus Dredd chase, I think was a fantastic way to bring that section of the story to a close, you know, in a very exciting way for a number of reasons, not just because of the script and art, as we found out later on in Prog 610, but we'll talk about that later as well.
So I think I'm right in saying that previous Titan collections of the earlier Dredd epics, it was usually split over two volumes, whereas this one fits into a nice slim one volume of Titan. But as you said, you quite like that because it's a nice, snappy, fairly quick, you can read it pretty much in one sitting epic of a Dredd, isn't it?
Yeah, I've never actually seen the Titan two-part. I've always assumed it was just this one complete one.
Because the Apocalypse War was spread over two parts, and I think the Cursed Earth as well. And it says on the back here, in fact, Judge Child was three Titan collections.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they were definitely split over. But I don't think this one was. I think this City of the Dab has always been one collection.
Yeah, just one slim volume, yeah.
Yeah, I could be wrong. But yeah, I mean, epics like the Apocalypse War need to be split over two, don't they? And also, well, you could argue that actually Apocalypse War is split over three because there's a separate one for Blockmania as well. So, and it's one of those things where I don't think you can have the Apocalypse War without having Blockmania before it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's talk about the artists, because we've got four artists on this. We're going to get to what is probably the best of the four for this particular epic in a moment, and we're all going to tell. Yes, we are going to tell that story. Let's go through them, because if we start with Ron Smith, now I'm a big fan of Ron Smith, but I know that on this particular epic, you sometimes find him slightly comical for a serious dread epic.
Yeah, I think it's the subject matter. I'm also a huge fan of Ron Smith. I absolutely love his work on Chopper and the first American graffiti story, and an American graffiti, wasn't it? Yeah. And also the Daily Dreads, I'm a huge, huge fan of. And in fact, I was probably reading the Daily Dreads before it became a regular 2000 AD reader. So Ron Smith has always got a place in my heart. And I just love his caricatures and stuff. Quite often when you see in the main story, when there's a setting with lots of kind of like citizens, the citizens are just like caricatures and stuff, aren't they? And often very, very comical. The only piece of Ron Smith art that I own is a Daily Dread, and it's where this guy dresses up as Judge Death just to kind of like pull a prank on his wife, gives his wife a heart attack. And you see him being led away and cussed by Dread, you know, and then you see like, holy moly. And there's this kind of caricature. So for the kind of comical kind of like side of things, and these caricatures and so on, Ron Smith, great. Love him every time. For City of the Damned, I'm not so sure. I like it, but it doesn't always necessarily suit the tone of what Wagner and Grant were going for necessarily. What do you think?
Well, I mean, because the Titan collection, it's all in black and white. So Ron Smith, I always love looking at his black and white stuff. I'm always slightly less keen when it's in colour. But I can see what you mean about him being slightly comedic in places. I mean, I found, this is where you and I have got, very slight differences, because I found Ian Gibson's work here looked slightly more comical to me. Obviously, again, we love Ian Gibson for Robo Hunter and for Halo Jones. Mm. But the bit when Dredd is encountering yet another one of these scaly dinosaur-like monsters looks very Ian Gibson-y to me. And then, of course, we've got the famous scene of Dredd crawling through the fire. Eyeless in hell. We should say, of course, this is the Dredd epic where Dredd gets his bionic eyes. crawling eyeless through hell. I probably wanted somebody else to do that rather than Ian Gibson, even though, again, love Ian Gibson work.
Yeah. Now, if I was to rank the artists in this particular series one by one, I'd probably put Gibson below Ron Smith.
But only
just. I think they're kind of like on a par in terms of not quite, as you say, not quite suited for the subject matter. That said, I mean, that double page, which presumably would have been in color in the prog, of Dredd dragging himself through the fire, I do really like that. And it reminded me of Toby in Halo Jones crashing through the wall on fire, you know.
Yeah, hot digital dog.
Yes, that's it. That's the one. Yeah. So in that regard, I was more than happy to accept Gibson as an artist, in this epic. Although I do absolutely take your point about how these dinosaurs look almost like, well, it's almost like scaly Godzukis.
Yes.
yeah. So I entirely see what you mean about those scaly reptile things.
So we've got Ron Smith, we've got Ian Gibson. We then have possibly the most controversial of the four artists, Kim Raymond, who didn't do a lot of Dredd. Alan Grant, we know, was not a particular fan of his Dredd art. And in Thrill Power Overload, I think it says that one of the reasons that Alan wanted to chuck the towel in was because he didn't like Kim's art on this. He does draw lovely ladies, doesn't he, Kim Raymond?
Well, yeah, as I've already mentioned, as a 14-year-old looking, 14 or 15-year-old looking at the seductive vampire Hershey, I was very enamored with that. I'm quite saddened, really, that Grant was so disappointed with Raymond's art in this, because I quite like it. If I was to rank all four of them, he would be at the bottom, but that doesn't necessarily represent what I feel about the artwork, because I do very much enjoy it. Not only the seductive Hershey, but we've also got a quite interesting take on Anderson with the kind of like flowing hair. And also I really like the dynamism of each frame. There's all kinds of action going on here, particularly when they're battling through the Hell Street Blues. The pages where Anderson actually bites one of the vampires to get it off her, you know, is brilliant. And also combined with some of the combined with the script of Wagner and Grant, we've got some great scenes, almost reminiscent of the recent Dredd film, where Anderson and Dredd have to execute what's left of the room full of perps. You know, you've got this scene where Hershey says, you know, you never were the romantic type, were you, Joe? And he just says no, and you just see the gunshot, and that's that. And then similarly with Anderson, there's a bit of chit-chat, and you just see the gunshot. And I think that those frames are very effective and done very well by Raymond. So, and I think his artwork appears towards the end as well, doesn't it, before Dylan comes back in.
Yeah.
And perhaps this is where I wasn't quite so keen on it, when they were blowing bits of the dead Dredd away, and then there was a kind of problem where when it turned then to another artist, the dead Dredd was somehow complete again. I found that a little bit jarring, but that doesn't really take away from Kim Raymond's art. I mean, that's just, I guess, what happens when you are hopping from artist to artist on these things. So
I was looking up Kim Raymond because he did some Future Shocks. I know he did some Roy the Rovers. I don't know if this is right, but I've got a feeling he might have done Modesty Blaze at one point as well.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then, of course, he goes off to work for Disney as an sort of doing animation and storyboarding and stuff like that, which I'm going to guess probably pays better than 2000 AD.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Well, I'm glad of that. I'm glad that his art was appreciated somewhere. I think he's definitely one of the 2000 AD alumni, and that's in good part because the City of the Damned, I'm very fond of this story as a whole, and therefore I'm very fond of his art in it, you know. So
Ron Smith, Ian Gibson, Kim Raymond, let's turn to what's probably the star of the show, but if not in the best art, but at least gets the best story. Steve Dillon, what do you make of his artwork when he comes on City of Damned? He starts it off. And then he keeps coming back throughout the run, doesn't he?
Yeah. Now, I think Steve Dillon's art is the star of the show, personally, regardless of what parts of the story that he was given. I mean, you could argue that being given the start of the story wasn't massively dramatic or action-packed, and yet, nonetheless, he still managed to pack some action in there, such as Faye's vision of the citizens being taken out by these demonic forces, and even just Dredd and Anderson running to the sink to throw up. captures a lot of kinetic action and movement. Poor Anderson is like, you know, knock-kneed, throwing up in the sink there, and Dredd holding his hand over his mouth and dashing. Dear, it made me laugh, you know. And then, of course, you have the time machine distorting their faces and so on as they travel through time. So even from the opening, a few frames, I'm like, yeah, great. I'm really sold on this. You know, I loved Dylan right from the outset. This, in fact, I think this is, along with Cry of the Werewolf, I think this is one of my favorite Dylan stories.
The first episode, the prologue, as it's called, is six pages. Obviously, John and Alan, drawn by Steve Dillon, lettered by Tom Frame. It's remarkable sort of how much they can fit in the six pages, because they've got to explain the Judge Child quest. They've got to explain a prediction. They've got to explain a new time machine. They've got to prepare Dredd and Anderson for their voyage, including the bit of them being given something to make them throw up. And then they actually throw them forward in time in the Proteus machine. And Dylan does all that in six pages. It's incredibly dramatic. You got the briefing from Magruder as well. It's just, yeah. I mean, I know we always talk about definitive Dredd artists, but Steve Dillon is one of them.
Oh, absolutely.
His chin and his Dredd sneer, almost unrivaled.
Yeah, he's always been the definitive Dredd for me. He's always been my favorite Dredd artist for those very reasons. And when I was a young kind of like artist in, you know, doing A-level art and art foundation and so on, it was whenever I was copying Dredd on the back of my textbooks, whatever it was always Steve Dillon's Dredd that I was copying. And it's great that Dillon was paired with Wagner and Grant on this and other great stories like Cry of the Werewolf, because it really cemented him amongst the Dredd alumni, didn't it? And as you say, every page has got, a minimum of six panels, if not more, packed full of storytelling, yet never losing pace, never losing any definition, always details. And the final frame, as they glance out onto Mega City 1 for the first time, and Anderson's going, sweet mercy. And even Dredd is like, you never see Dredd shocked, do you? But here he is. And Dylan has just captured it perfectly. The old stony face, the stone is broken.
I mean, part of the reason that the other three artists get slightly short shrift from us on City of the Damned is because certainly when I read it, I'm always waiting for Dylan to come back.
100% agree. You're right. And perhaps for that reason, we've probably been a bit hard on the other artists, you know, because they do an admirable job, as we've already discussed. But yeah, you are absolutely correct. The covers that Dylan has done, every time he makes a reappearance, you're straight back in the story with no qualms whatsoever. And Dylan's art pairs really well with the black humor from Wagner and Grant. So, for example, there's that scene where they're looking over the hollow slug from the Hell Street Sector House just to try and figure out what's been happening to the city. And they see that Anderson's been promoted to the head of Psy Division. And she's like, oh, what do you know? I got a promotion. And she's kind of like giving Dredd's helmet a kind of like flirty rub, you know, going, hey, wow, aren't I the thing? And then the next scene you see is a head's melting from some psychic blaster. Then Dredd's like, congratulations. Oh, good. And again, that black humor is captured so well by Steve Dillon, isn't it? I don't think I've ever seen any other judge kind of like flirt with Dredd and gently caress his helmet every time, almost, you know, and get away with it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yet
Steve Dillon just nails it. And there's so many other kind of great moments like that here, you know.
It would be nice. I mean, you know, if we had our choice, we'd like a Dredd epic to be all by the same artist. You know, you it's almost impossible to get a Carlos who can do the Apocalypse War for a year and just draw his arm off for a whole year with, I think, they gave him 1 week break or something like that, didn't they?
Oh, bless him, yeah.
If anybody could do it, I think we would have liked Steve Dillon to have done the whole thing, wouldn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that would have elevated this probably up into my top five, whereas at the moment I think it just makes it into my top 10. Dylan all the way through, it's a dream, isn't it? And I mean, if we could come to the story now, he did prove that he could have potentially done it, you know. I mean,
let's turn to Prague 404, getting towards the end of this epic. Because as you say, Steve Dillon, if anybody could have done it weekly, maybe it was Steve Dillon, because Prague 404 comes with a story. and I've put in our notes, because I think it's just the first splash page that they already had ready for the color separations, didn't they? But they needed the other four pages.
Yeah. Now, if I recall, it was in Prog 610 where they reprinted these, and it was the page where, just to try and describe them very briefly, one where Dredd and Anderson are supporting each other through corridors as the dead Dredd is following them, or what did Anderson call him? Geek Dredd or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the next page where they tried to get the teleporter up and running, and then the page where the mutant Judge Child realizes their ploy and the dead Dredd crashes through a wall, and then finally the page where dead Dredd has got his hands wrapped around real Dredd's neck and is trying to throttle him. So I think it was those four pages, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm not sure which pages actually ended up in the Titan reprint. Do you know?
So the ones in the Titan reprint are the ones that were printed in the comic, which had the lettering on them.
Right. Okay.
Because I think the originals. So basically what we're talking about is four pages of lost Steve Dillon artwork. Yeah. And I think the originals never got lettered
by
Tom Frame, even mm-hmm. though, well, in fact, as we know, because Dillon does swap the positions of Dredd and Anderson to fit in better with the word balloons. So we've got the initial color pages fine. They've got four pages of black and white art by Steve Dillon. And the, as you say, Prog 610 is the interesting one, which I've got in front of me, because that's where they reprinted both the published pages and Steve Dillon's original pages side by side. And, of course, mm-hmm. they tell one version of the story in Prog 610. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So if I recall, no, I don't have 610 in front of me, but I remember them saying that the pages were just lost down the back of a cupboard or on the back of a shelf or something somewhere. So they gave us a very, very PG-rated version of the story so that, you know, they didn't subvert the minds of the readers as if they hadn't done that already. But as it turns out, that wasn't the whole story, was it? But not by a long shot. So, Eamon, I'll hand it back to you to tell the rest.
Well, so you can find the Steve McManus and John Higgins version of the story. I think you gave us a link, which I'll put in the show notes, to Comic Book Resources. I think it's in Thrill Power Overload as well. That basically Tom Frame, you know, legendary letterer, lived in Kentish Town in London. Steve McManus had his artwork in a portfolio and went to meet Tom Frame, and they went to the pub. And I think they went to more than one pub. And it became a bit of a session. And somehow or other, this artwork, they were due to turn in to presumably King's Reach Tower, I should guess.
Yeah.
Got lost.
What was it? Did you say Steve McManus or Steve Dillon and Tom Frame?
So it was Steve Dillon and Tom Frame on the pub crawl. Steve McManus crawl. And John Higgins, I think, told the story in Thrill Power Overload. Sure. So Steve Dillon and Tom Frame are on a pub crawl. They lose the four pages. I think actually I've just looked because it was a color center spread that was already done. So that is
as it was
printed, and then the four black and white pages that were to come after that get lost over the weekend.
Right.
Or rather, they get lost on the Friday, which is when they were due to be handed in. So Steve Dillon, Tom Frame, a couple of housemates, possibly a chap called Steve O'Leary, spend possibly one of the hardest weekends in comic book history because they redo the four pages over the weekend and take them and hand them in on Monday. And then
I was just going to say, which given the actual four pages is incredible because these four pages aren't very simple pages at all, are they? There's tons of stuff going on in them. I think the redrawn versions are almost as dense in detail as the originals. And as you say, some of them have actually been rejigged slightly as well. So for example, Anderson and Dredd are swapped over in the first of the four missing pages. I think in terms of the the detail and what we actually ended up with. Perhaps Mega City 1 is looking slightly less decayed.
Right.
but otherwise, that's about it. Otherwise, it's just as dynamic, it's just as detailed.
I think I actually prefer the pages that he did over the weekend. I think they're slightly better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost as if that rush has added a little bit more dynamism to the art, isn't it? A bit more kinetic feel. Yeah,
and then to complete the story, they hand in the finished pages on the Monday. And then, of course, Steve Dillon and Tom Frame decide to celebrate by going to the pub. They go to the Assembly House pub in Kentish Town. You know, nowadays you'd be able to contact somebody, wouldn't you, by their mobile. You'd probably be able to find somebody who knew them. But the barman says, oh, we've got your portfolio here, Steve, and hands him back the lost artwork.
Ah, brilliant. Yeah.
Just astonishing.
And they must have been... of course we left it here.
We could perhaps decry the sort of drinking culture that surrounded comic books back in the 80s, at least in British ones. But at the same time, it's given us one of the great legendary stories about the artwork associated with 2000 AD. And it's slightly nice to have a story about 2000 AD artwork that doesn't involve the artwork being destroyed or used to mop up floods and things like that, or cut up.
Yeah.
Instead, we've got Steve Dillon redoing four pages over a weekend and actually managing to improve on his first effort. And then the original artwork turns up as well.
Yeah. And at the same time, I think we've got probably an example of where Steve Dillon has an awakening of sorts, where he realizes that he can turn over artwork really quickly, you know. And then I think we see in later Dreads the beginnings of his style that eventually landed with Preacher, whereby he started to pare down the detail but still maintain, you know, the sense of movement, the sense of dread, the sense of his presence and his glower and so on, however with not as much density of detail. And then by the time we get to Preacher, you can see that detail. Well, I mean, the artwork in Preacher is almost minimalist compared to earlier Dillon, isn't it? And I'm guessing that by that time, he's really reached a peak where he's gone, I can still capture the flavor of all these characters, but turn the artwork over maybe almost twice as fast, you know, and hit those really heavy deadlines that these long series are so reliant upon. That's my theory anyway.
Well, that's interesting. It's a very interesting idea that this may have led to his great work on Preacher. Still waiting for somebody to pick that for the book club, I'll just say. It's fascinating. You know, Steve Dillon, he could turn out these pages over a weekend with the help from his friends. And it's just wonderful. And of course, there we are. They're printed side by side in 610, and I will put that link to the CBR story. It's one of their comic myths debunked or, you know, explored series. But you sent me the link, and I'll put it in the show notes for this episode.
Lovely.
So people can go and have a look.
Fantastic.
Right, well, let's turn back to Dread Epics. What makes a great Dread Epic, in your opinion, Dave?
God, blimey. Now, what a question. I mean, I guess to answer that, I probably have to look at the other Dread Epics that I've really enjoyed. Always at number one for me is going to be Blockmania going into Apocalypse War, because it's such a vast tale and it encompasses so much and it's got everything you want in there. You've got a whole host of kind of like secondary characters. You've got the City Death units and Blockmania. You've got the poor woman who had the 2 cred Freezy Whip lands in her face, who kicked it all off, you know, an amazing kind of like supporting cast. And it just escalates and escalates and escalates, doesn't it? And you've also got a great villain, with, you know, the Solve leader who's on this huge power trip. You've also got Dread being like, really, you could even argue quite evil in that epic as well, because it incinerates East Meg 1. And then what other ones are my favorites? Cry of the Werewolf, amazing artwork. again, great villain, the big white werewolf. Fantastic. So that's it. Something you've got to have in there. And then Day of Chaos, where Dredd's choices in his earlier life come back to haunt him in the city quite dramatically. And I think for the first time you see Dredd broken. And then the other epics I really like are the ones with the kind of like political sites. So Letters from Democrat America, that kind of thing, where we really explore where the villains actually become the judges themselves. And you get to explore the lives of the citizens under the boot heel of what's essentially a fascist paramilitary, police state, police regime. How do I summarize that? So big cast of supporting characters, villain of some kind, something that someone either endures and either succeeds or fails, as we've seen in some of these, and really gripping episodic writing, cliffhangers, and of course, artwork, always the artwork. I think in every single one of those that I've mentioned, the artwork is superlative, isn't it? Carlos Esquerra, Mike McMahon, Brian Bolland, Steve Dillon, who else did I mention? Letter from a Democrat, John Higgins, Colin McNeil in America.
America.
I think it's amazing that all of those elements have just come together so often for Judge Dredd stories. I mean, how hard is it to be able to nail down that talent and not just nail it down, but also have the talent bounce off each other so well? Have the artist be able to look at the writing and go, yeah, I know how to make that really work. And I think that's one of the reasons that I really love 2000 AD over so many other comics, because 2000 AD so often gets it right, not just in Judge Dredd, whereas you don't always see that perfect fusion of story, artist, and storytelling as often in other, comics, if you ask, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty of people who would disagree.
Well, to go back to what you were saying, we do like to see Dredd put through the ringer, physically and or mentally. And of course, even though I've said I'm not quite so sure about Ian Gibson, but eyeless Dredd crawling through the fire with some memorable writing from John and Alan about that sequence is great stuff. And of course, you said a good villain. Now, there's the Chrysler Mutant, but also I think having Dredd, Dead Dredd or Geek Dead Dredd be the sort of villain who chases them is pretty good, because you can't get, in a way, tougher for Dredd than having to face himself.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And there's some great lines during that as well, where the black humor is still there. Now, I haven't got the book open on the white page, so I'll just try and kind of like guess, but there's a scene where, Anderson's been kind of like shot in the leg and she's immobile, and Dredd says, "Oh, I'll have to carry you." "Oh, no, you don't have to carry me, leave me behind. But you're my eyes." "Oh, so you'd leave me behind, I couldn't see," or something like that, which was just great. In the meanwhile, this presence of the dead Dredd kind of like on their tail and gaining ground very, very quickly. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And as you say, what better villain for Dredd than a dead version of himself? He knows his every move, has got all of his skills, probably. I don't know how much rigor mortis might have affected them, but he certainly seemed to be a good shot. So, yeah, and there was a couple of lucky misses. And also, when Dead Dredd finally did catch up with him, it was clear that Dead Dredd was winning in that fight in Proteus, right?
Yeah.
If the Judge Child's influence hadn't suddenly been cut off by the time travel, then I don't think real Dredd would have won that fight.
No, he was losing. Yeah. So great stuff. Now, obviously, as I say, it is in a way curtailed because John and Alan decided to wrap it up. But it does give us what you've described as a very snappy, quick read in a way. It's an epic that you can do in an evening. And it does bear rereading, doesn't it? It's a good one for having another look at.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a real nostalgia trip for me. I mean, I don't think I'd read this for about a decade, if not more. And this copy of City of the Damned that I have here, the Titan reprint, I actually bought on eBay about a decade ago, and it's been sat on my shelves gathering dust. I just wanted it back in my collection, after giving my previous version away. When I saw it going for a song on eBay, I couldn't resist. in terms of the story and how it ends, I find the ending very, very satisfying because they is a neat trick, the way that Wagner gets Dredd to go, oh, there's a solution, but I better not think about it. I better just do it. Otherwise, the mutant Chrysler will be able to read my mind and it'll all be lost. And then when they get back to Mega City 1 and Proteus, and, you know, they stagger through the doors of Proteus, and the tech judge is like, oh my God, they've only been gone for 2 minutes. Oh, it could have been months or years. What's in there? We don't know. And then they go in and they find another Dredd. Like, oh, it's got to be Dredd. Look at his jaw. Absolutely brilliant. And then, of course, we get the classic quote, don't we, of he gets his new eyes and he says, oh, you know, 20/20 vision, night vision, and if I may only regret, I hadn't had this done years ago. It's just typical Dredd. And then, of course, they have to go and, is it Grunwalder's palace? They have to
Grunwalder,
go
yeah.
Yeah, just before, just as the mutant Judge Child is being rebirthed from this tank and takes out the assistant, the robot assistant, and they get there just in time to finish him off, toss him in the flames, and then, you know, sorry, Grunwalder, nothing against you, but nothing personal, but we've got to take you out as well. We can't have you making any more of these. So he goes up in flames too, courtesy of Justice One. I think it was Justice One that they were in, wasn't it, the spaceship?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, how do you end an epic like this? I think Anderson at the end really kind of like sums up Dredd. Look, if you've got these bionic peepers and you've got dead Dredd in the Black Museum, does this mean that the future's still going to happen? Or if it hasn't happened, why do these things still exist? And he's like, oh, search me, Anderson. And then she finishes with a typical Anderson quip. Oh, yeah, and find myself doing 5 in a cube. You got to be joking. Which, you know, is cheesy as hell, but it's pure Anderson, isn't it? Always there in the kind of like, in those moments where there are no words, she finds the words. Yeah.
And as ever, when we've got a time travel paradox, it's more or less, oh, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Don't think about it too much. Yeah.
Out under the carpet. Yeah. Don't worry too much about it. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I think, you know, what was the other thing that got me? I might have mentioned it already. I think it was perhaps that bits of Dredd were kind of like the dead Dredd were blown away and yet they magically reappear later on. So there are continuity issues and stuff as well. But nonetheless, yeah, it came to a very satisfactory conclusion for me. And in fact, in the conclusion, well, was possibly one of my grail pages. I don't know if we're ready to come to that yet or not, but...
Well, why don't we do it? Why don't we jump in and play grail pages? We've got four artists to choose from. We've also got a bunch of covers, some of which are in the Titan collection as well. What are you going to choose to hang on your wall virtually in the art gallery of Mega City Book Club?
For me, my grail page is bizarrely... It's Steve Dillon, but it's possibly the one where the least is happening and there's actually only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 frames for a change, not the traditional 6, 7, 8 or even more. And it's the page where Proteus returns and they're all there going, how is it coming back so quickly? It's only been a minute. And they're like, oh, it could have been days or months even. Oh, my God, guns ready just in case, open her up. And then, sweet mercy, Dredd and Anderson come out. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, Dredd and Anderson come out. And they're just ruined. Dredd's there with his wrecked eyes and the bullet hole in his knee pad. And Anderson's just kind of like got a look on her face of just shell shock, hasn't she? You know, and... it's a simple page, but God, you can just see everything that those judges have been through, right?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's pure Steve Dillon. It's almost Grail panel, just that panel of Dredd and Anderson sort of, you know, coming out of Proteus. But yeah, what a page. Proteus reappears. She's clear. Open her up. Sweet mercy. Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, if it wasn't that one, I think a close contender would be the one where the dead Dredd is crashing through the wall. And yet again, you know, it's all, as you say, it's almost a one panel grail panel.
Yeah.
He's so good at these one panel grail moments, isn't he? Even on the next page where Dredd has been throttled by the dead Dredd, that panel's just superb. the close-up. But anyway, that's mine. So what would your page be? What would your Grail page be?
Well, before we do that, I'll say we'll give you that page, which is 86 in the Titan collection. We'll also give you page 80, which is Dead Dread crashing through the wall.
Oh, thank you very much.
In the redrawn Steve Dillon version.
Oh, lovely.
If we stick with Steve Dillon, mm-hmm. I'm going to say this is going to be a slight cheat, Dave, because I'm going to look at page 81. So that's the page immediately after Dead Dread comes through the wall. But I'm actually going to cheat and choose the original from Prog 610. Those two pages, I think, are the closest together. And I'm only doing it, although I think the redone art is probably slightly better, I'm only doing it because I'd love that piece of comic history and the story that goes with it, you know?
Fantastic, yeah.
I don't know who owns this Steve Dillon artwork now and if they, you know, who owns both versions. But, yeah, we're going to stick with Steve Dillon. We're going to have two pages for you. We're going to have the original page from Prog 610 for me of Dread being choked by his Dead Dread opponent.
That's an interesting question you raise, actually. Who does own those pages of artwork? Because I'm aware that in the 2000 AD art of Steve Dillon collection, I don't think City of the Damned actually appears in it.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So someone must have them somewhere, but I don't think it's the Steve Dillon family or 2000 AD themselves. So.
As ever. Yes, because I don't think I saw any of these in the exhibition.
No.
Okay, interesting. But anyway, there we go. Yeah. I was tempted by the Bill Sienkiewicz cover because it's Bill Sienkiewicz.
Oh, are we not doing covers? Because if that would be my choice if we were doing covers.
Sorry, right. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, covers as well. So we give you guests go first. So you get the Bill Sienkiewicz cover.
Oh, did you want it? Like, I'll let you have it.
And no. I will take Ron Smith, Hell Street Blues.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic cover. Yeah, with the cultural references splashed there on the page. Brilliant. Yeah.
Great stuff. So, two pages for you and the Bill Sienkiewicz cover for the Titan edition.
Thank you very much. I don't know
how they got Bill Sienkiewicz to do a cover in 1986, but there you go.
I'm pretty sure he did a couple of
covers,
didn't he? Yeah.
And I'll have an original lost page and then refound page of Steve Dillon artwork, plus a Ron Smith cover. So there we go. Great stuff.
Excellent. Great choices.
And as you said, the Titan collection that we are both holding is fairly cheap still on eBay. You can find copies. And for some reason, on mine, I've said lots of bad things about the Titan binding over the years on this podcast. Mine is holding together quite nicely on this one.
Mine's perfect.
Yeah. Perhaps by the 24th Titan edition, they were starting to get this figured out with the glue. But there you go. It's also, of course, you can find it in Case Files 8, as I said, £15 for a hard copy of that, £10 digital if you want to get hold of City of the Damned in a more modern collection. So there we go. Great stuff. Well, what a fascinating epic. So many stories about it. In a way, almost the stories around it are just as interesting as the content in a way.
Absolutely.
So, Dave, guest projects time. Now, first of all, I said you've got musical instruments behind you because you play one of the least portable musical instruments there is. Doing the harp.
I'm still doing the harp, yeah. So that's my Venus Penti Grand Concert that you can see behind me. And I've also got a small Salvi Hermine lever harp over in the other corner as well, which is a lot easier to transport. The Venus Penti, when I have to take it for servicing or take it to a concert or wherever, I can just about fit it in my Nissan Note. But I am leaning over slightly with the steering wheel, the harp pressed up against my face, you know. I've been playing it for about 15 years, and I recently, in the last 6 months, got my grade 6 performance exam.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I got a merit from the ABRSM, so I'm very, very pleased with that, which was gained through, instead of doing three pieces and then a bunch of scales and other kind of technical things, it's a performance exam. So you actually do four pieces, three from a list, and then one you can choose yourself. And the one I chose myself was Stairway to Heaven in traditional Wayne's World style.
Nice.
I decided, yes, Stairway.
Stairway.
Yeah, it's a lovely arrangement by David Ice, which isn't quite as long as the original Stairway, but it make, you know, captures all the elements of it. And I think it sounds lovely. So I was very pleased with that. So, yeah. So you never know. I might actually reach, I'm doing grade 7 now. I might actually reach grade 8 by the time I'm about 60. Who knows?
Or by the next time. You might have grade 7 next time you come on the pod.
Yeah, yeah.
And also musical connections, because you wanted to mention some bands that have got 2000 AD connections.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you saw me at Lawless last May, you might have been the lucky recipient of one of the Henge 3D extravaganzas. So to explain, the band Henge released three comic books based on the kind of like onstage personas. They say that they're three aliens and one human come down to spread musical joy to you know, the human race and whatnot. And the 2000 AD link is that the covers were done by Boo Cook. And inside the comics themselves, the writing was done by Tom Eglinton, who I believe has written for 2000 AD. The artwork was done by Phil Buckingham inside, who I'm not sure if he did work for 2000 AD or not. But nonetheless, the 3D extravaganza bit, well, that's where I come in, because 3D is another one of my passions. I do 3D photography and so on. And I actually converted Boo Cook's cover and the first three pages of the comic into 3D, and then filled the rest out with 3D photography of the band in action on stage. And also some, I don't know if you remember the kind of like Panini style sticker books.
That Yeah.
I did versions, Henge very kindly let me do a 3D photo shoot of them. So I did kind of like portraits of them in 3D with space backgrounds and whatnot. And then compiled that. It was a prototype just to see if we could kind of like do something in 3D for the band. I printed off 100 copies for the band, and they took it on European tour of them and gave them away to people who very kindly put them up, or organizers of events and so on. And I've been slowly giving them away to people like fans who clearly have bought loads of merch. They get a copy, and also Boo Cook himself has got a copy of his cover in 3D, which he I've got a great 3D picture of him looking at it with his like 3D specs on at Lawless last year. So that was good fun. So, and also Henge have got did their own design, which they asked me to convert into 3D. And if you go to one of their gigs, check out their t-shirts. The last gig I was at, they still had some left, a white t-shirt with the design converted into 3D by me. When you wear it and someone looks at you, it's like a portal into another dimension where you see Henge basically. And they even come with branded Henge 3D glasses. So I managed to kind of like persuade Henge to get on board with the whole 3D thing, which is great. But they're super rare. They're available at the gigs only, not on the website. Also, talking about Boo Cook, he did the artwork for their last album, Journey to Volta's B.
All right.
And this is particularly interesting because he had, the interior art, he had to do two versions. The vinyl is really clever. The B side is double threaded. And depending on where you drop the needle, you're either going to get a happy ending to this kind of album, or you're going to get a very dark 2000 AD-esque ending to the story that kind of threads through the whole album kind of thing. And it's a really, really clever thing. The double pressing means you just don't know which ending you're going to get. So Boo, in his artwork, actually had to do two kind of bits of interior artwork where you flip it over. One's the happy ending where all the city's nice and pristine and lovely, and then the dark ending where everything's all an irradiated wasteland like the cursed earth. So if you get the opportunity, grab that album. Not only is it just an excellent album, I really love it, but Boo Cook's art really makes it. And so the beautiful exterior artwork as well, black and silver with Boo's spaceship design and the planet Volta's B and so on, is this orb that's just a fringe of light. It's wonderful. Talking of Boo, actually, another thing I almost brought to mention, two things. I won a charity auction for Boo's prototype of that album cover. So
you won a Grail page.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I'm really pleased. I haven't turned up yet, but I'm very much looking forward to receiving that. And then also, let's give Boo a bit of a shout out for his band as well. His band Crab are playing at the Strange Days Festival in September. The Strange Days Festival is kind of like a 14 Times-esque kind of thing with guest speakers talking about cryptids and whatnot. Brian Blessed is going to be there talking about Sasquatch and Yeti and goodness knows what other stuff Brian Blessed talks about. And the headliners are going to be Henge again, but also Boo Cook's band Crab are going to be playing there too. So I think that's worth a nice shout out for Boo.
Well, it's fantastic. You've won a literal, actual Grail page from Boo Cook. We'll put a link in the show notes to Boo's band Crab and possibly to the Strange Days Festival as well. Because we were working out beforehand, he's got another band with Cy Davis as well. He does Forktail, doesn't he?
Yeah, now that's a band I'd not heard of before, so that was a bit of a surprise to me. I'm going to have to check them out.
Right. That's his folk horror band with Cy Davis, I think. He's a musical man, Boo Cook. He's a man of many talents, like yourself, Dave.
I guess he's an artist through and through, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Look at it, yeah.
So, excellent stuff. Look out for Henge in concert and that 3D t-shirt. Look out for the album cover by Boo Cook. And look out for Boo's own musical projects, some of which will be in the show notes of this episode as well, hopefully.
Brilliant.
Great stuff, Dave. Thank you very much.
Well, no, thank you, Eamon. It's been wonderful to come on again. And it's been absolutely fantastic talking about one of my favorite Dread epics. I think probably I'd rank this kind of like maybe number 10. It's definitely in my top 10, but it's probably at number 10 just with things like the Apocalypse War and Day of Chaos and Chopper and so on, just leading in front of it a bit. But it's been such a joy to revisit it. It's a real nostalgia trip to be able to go through that again. So thank you very much.
City of the Damned, it's a cracker. Thank you, Dave. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, find all of these links that we've been talking about at megacitybookclub.com. Go to the socials the week after this episode comes out: Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and the 2080 forums to see some of this artwork that we've been drooling over and choosing as grails. And if you've got a book or a story or a creator that you want to come on and talk about, email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. Also, send me your top 10 2000 AD covers of all time to mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. Maybe Hell Street Blues will make the list. We'll see. That'll do us. Until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
And it's goodbye from him. Well, and from me. Thanks, guys.